The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Simulation training in critical care is presented by Dr. Christopher Brackney.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I had the opportunity to give a lecture on simulation in critical care about 5 years ago. And as I was preparing for this talk, I started looking through my old slides and I was looking at where we were 5 years ago, where we are today. And it's amazing to me the progress that we've made. Disclosures, we'll just get this out of the way. I have none. So what are we going to talk about today? We're going to briefly touch on education, some theories behind education, the way that we teach today versus the way that we were probably taught as we were coming up, and then how that relates a little bit to simulation. I'm going to briefly touch on task trainers, whole body simulators, and then the bulk of the lecture will be about high fidelity simulation, immersion simulation, and how to integrate simulation into your hospital processes. So teaching centered. The traditional approach was that I stand up here and I give you a lecture and you get out of it whatever you get out of it. And it's really dependent on my skills, how fancy my slides are, and you're gonna learn passively. You're gonna absorb concepts, you're gonna take notes, and then the outcomes are just gonna be based on essays or multiple choice questions. Moving forward, as teaching has progressed, the teacher is more of a quarterback, if you will, a manager of resources. We are to develop clear, measurable objectives, organize a variety of learning experiences, motivate our students to be self-directed learners, and then evaluate student performance and then give immediate feedback. So who are adult learners? These are your teachers. This is what that you are, you're adult learners. You're self-directed. And as a teacher, I need to facilitate guiding you. I don't need to spoon feed you. You're motivated to do so. You're goal oriented. You have predetermined goals. That's why you're here. On this table that you see is Bloom's taxonomy. Is everybody familiar with this? Just a show of hands if you've heard of Bloom's taxonomy. Okay, so a couple people. This is actually what this is it's the different order of thinking skills. And it starts with basic knowledge and it goes all the way up through evaluation. And that's just a continuum of mastery of skills. And that's what you're trying to do as you teach. Again, characteristics of adult learners, they're relevancy oriented. You require feedback, you're very motivated. But one of the key things is you require respect. In medical education, I teach with a lot of medical students, they want to be able to voice their opinions. You have to hear them out. It's not just my way or the highway. It's getting feedback from them. How do we create a teaching process or a course? Well, first, we create educational objectives. We apply the Bloom's taxonomy. We utilize various teaching techniques. We evaluate performance, and then we give appropriate feedback. So how do we develop these educational objectives? Or what is an objective? It's a statement of purpose. It describes specifically what I, as a teacher, want you to learn. There are three domains. There's a cognitive, the affective, and the psychomotor. And I've just made some examples of sample educational objectives. And so you can be the judge of which one is requiring the learner to learn or just state a fact. So as an objective for a course, you could say, well, I just want them to be able to manage an unresponsive patient. Or I want the learner to check for a pulse immediately, check a blood glucose, inquire about opiate use, administer 40 micrograms of Narcan, provide bag mask ventilation if an airway is not protected. Which one would say the latter is definitely more defined, and it sets clear expectations for our learners. One more example is manages respiratory distress. Okay, well, that's very ambiguous. But the second one, check respiratory rate, place on a pulse oximeter, start 100% non-rebreather, and call for a rapid response team. So, feedback definition. It's a method of controlling a system by reinserting into the system the results of its performance. It provides the learner with specific information about their performance to reinforce or change their behavior. And it can be either formative or summative. So it can be either ongoing at the end of each day, or it can be at the end of, say, a rotation. It's much more helpful to have a combination of this, to have formative feedback throughout the day or at the end of the day when you're working with students, and then ultimately circle the wagons and have summative feedback at the end. What's the purpose of feedback? As an instructor, as a teacher, and I'm sure you're all teachers, it's your most powerful tool that you have. It provides a basis for maintaining or improving performance, and it provides a mechanism for assessing needs and providing learning experiences. The timing and setting are imperative. You want to establish this during the orientation that you're going to be providing feedback. It's going to be immediate feedback, and they should expect it. They should expect it daily, and it's part of their learning experience. So some other characteristics of effective feedback: have clear, unambiguous, specific, achievable goals. Base it on first-hand observation. It should always be a two-way conversation. I wouldn't want to have a partner, I wouldn't want to give feedback to a student if I hadn't worked with the student. And my partner worked with the student, said, yeah, you know, thumbs up. They were a good student. I shouldn't be giving that feedback to the student. I have no business giving that feedback. It should be a two-way conversation between the teacher and the learner. And that way it develops credibility to the learner. And you should base this feedback on behavior, not interpretations of behavior. Provide the feedback privately. Provide the learner with a way to succeed. And never give positive feedback before giving feedback that is intended to change behavior. And anybody that has kids knows that. You never want to say, hey, good job, before correcting some behavior. What happens in a system without feedback? Well, in surveys, and for all of you guys that are part of educational programs, we get surveys upon surveys upon surveys. And one of the most frequently cited deficiencies is actually the lack of feedback in the program. And it's why does that happen? There's failure to effectively evaluate performance. Sometimes the instructors are concerned it might lead to an emotional response of the learner. It may damage that learner-teacher relationship. But what happens? Mistakes go uncorrected, good performance goes unreinforced, and students start to generate their own feedback about themselves, which could be positive or negative. It's not a controlled environment. So I'm going to transition now and talk about different types of simulation. Simulation is one tool that you can use in teaching your students and teaching faculty, teaching staff. We're using it actually to maintain skill sets. We use a variety of things. We use whole body simulators. They're very effective for teaching large groups of individuals, and it allows people to experience rare life-threatening events without harm to the patient and without harm to themselves. It enables faculty to provide feedback, and it permits trainees to repeat performances until the objectives are met. So you can stop a simulation if somebody's not meeting the desired objective, and then keep going back until they actually obtain success. So these are just different task trainers. This is a picture actually from this past summer from Encampment, Wyoming. So some of the pictures will be from our family vacation. So the first immersive simulation project I want to talk to you about is something we piloted this past year. This was Sim ECMO. I worked with one of my mentees, Crystal Schaefer, and I worked with another faculty member, Dr. Emlett, and myself. We decided to do this workshop, and why did we do it? We were getting feedback from the endless surveys that we get, and what we had noted was that some of the fellows had kept repetitively saying that they didn't feel that they were, these are critical care fellows, that they did not feel prepared to manage solo complications that arise when patients are on ECMO. So we performed a gap analysis, and we looked at our program. We have a high-volume, reputable ECMO program. Our pre-rotation, so this again, this is for critical care fellows. Before they start their rotation, they get a written manual. They have a 3-hour online video series that they watch. But yet, despite that, they're still feeling like they're struggling to manage these patients, and rightfully so. There's a cardiac anesthesiologist, there's a cardiothoracic surgeon, there's an intensivist. All these people are standing at the bedside and making decisions. So it's difficult for that fellow, again, to be making solo decisions. So the purpose of this workshop was to serve as a training tool to educate critical care fellows on how to recognize, diagnose, and manage common things to ECMO. So this is just basic setup. We had a perfusionist, a respiratory therapist, bedside nurse, a critical care fellow, equipment. We used the Laerdal 3G Simman, a ventilator, ultrasound, cardiopulmonary bypass machine, and can't forget the red food coloring. So this is actually, I couldn't find a more recent picture, but this is actually, we were just mocking up the 3G Simman. These are the cannulas in the right neck and the right groin, and the patient is intubated. So we ran the fellows through three different scenarios. There was a hypovolemia scenario, and basically we had learning objectives for the fellows that they'd be able to identify low flow rates or chatter as a sign of hypovolemia, come up with a differential diagnosis for hypovolemia on ECMO, and then discuss the risks and benefits of stopping anticoagulation. This was actually, this particular scenario was a patient that was post-op day one from cardiopulmonary, had a CABG, and had post-op complications necessitating going back on ECMO, was on peripheral ECMO, and the goal was that the learner would come into the room, into the simulation lab, they would note these signs of hypovolemia, and they would expose the patient, and the right groin actually had this large ecchymosis or expanding hematoma, and they would have to contact the surgeon, that was the goal, give volume, give blood, and stop anticoagulation. The second scenario was a recirculation scenario, and the learning objectives was for the learner to recognize persistent hypoxemia after initiation of VV ECMO cannulation, and again, develop an appropriate differential diagnosis, and recognize flash on ECMO cannulas, and pull back the femoral cannula to prevent recirculation. Also to identify a pneumothorax as a complication of ECMO cannula placement. This was actually a patient that came in, 25-year-old male, MV, motor vehicle collision, who had blunt chest injuries and had significant pulmonary contusions. The patient was placed on VV ECMO, and shortly after the cannulation itself, they just couldn't get the sats to come up. And so the learner was either to use cardiac ultrasound or to obtain a chest radiograph or both and notice that the cannulas were very in close proximity and actually pull that femoral cannula back. And then also to notice that there's a pneumothorax, right-sided pneumothorax. The last scenario was an obstructive shock scenario. And this was, the learner was to correctly identify alarms on the ECMO circuit as indicative of low flow, formulate a differential diagnosis for, again, low ECMO flow and hemodynamic deterioration. and reinforced concepts of diagnosis and treatment of pericardial tamponade. So the fellow came into the simulation center, saw a patient that whose flows were low, blood pressure was had a narrow pulse pressure, and the goal was for them to obtain an ultrasound, come up with a differential diagnosis, take the ultrasound, and actually image the patient. For those of you that have worked with a 3G sim man, he doesn't have windows, so we had a task trainer there at the bedside. They obtained those images, and then we had another task trainer that we unveiled, if they got that far, and so that they could perform a pericardial synthesis. So how did we assess our learners? We had a pre and post test, which mimics some of the types of questions they would experience on their CCM boards. And we did a post simulation survey. Very, very good feedback from that, and we're incorporating this now into our curriculum. So this picture was taken 24 hours after the previous picture I showed you, and this is in June, and this is at Medicine Bow National Park. So SimTrach, by show of hands, how many people manage patients with tracheostomies and laryngectomies? It's a lot of hands. And of those hands, or out of anyone that's here, how many of you have a horror story or some disaster of managing somebody with a laryngectomy or a tracheostomy? Yeah, me too. SimTrach is a workshop on just that. It's managing patients with tracheostomies and laryngectomies. And this was actually the mentee was Dr. DeHita. She was a fifth year ENT resident, myself, and then one of the ENT surgeons. So we all have horror stories of these cases. The image on the on your right is going to be a scan, a postmortem scan. As you notice that I don't have a pointer, but there's a tracheostomy tube with a tip that's in the soft tissue. That's a bad zip code for that tracheostomy tube. The picture on the right, this is actually a laryngectomy patient that came through our ED. That's the stoma. That's a scab over the stoma. And you see that little elliptical opening is where the patient's breathing through. So they came in respiratory distress. So why did we do this workshop? There's a growing number of hospitalized patients with tracheostomies and laryngectomies, commonly performed procedure by ENT, thoracic surgery, general surgery, pulmonary CCM, and intensivists. There was a study in 2009 by McGrath that showed that 75% of 453 incidents associated with tracheostomy were associated with patient harm, 75%. 6% required life-saving care, and 15 patients died. Significant complications and death associated with laryngectomy patients, and we had no current training at our facility. So when I was approached by Dr. Eibling about this, I said, okay, well, let me look at the literature. Let me see what's out there, because you're right. I mean, this looks like a void in our training. And I looked at emergency medicine literature. I looked at internal medicine literature. I looked at critical care literature. I looked at the anesthesia literature and even surgery. I didn't see anything. There was no algorithmic approach to how to manage patients that had tracheostomies or laryngectomies. So there was a project that had been going on that Dr. Eibling had been involved with National Health Safety Project, and it was a joint project with a group over across the pond, the tracheostomy.org.uk, and they had a program that they had put together basically talking about different types of trachs, different types of tracheal tubes, the surgical procedure itself, and the emergent management of these patients, and the day-to-day management. This is one of the algorithms for emergency tracheostomy management. So this patient has a patent upper airway. And this one is for an emergency laryngectomy management. And so these are just algorithms. Who are our learners? Critical care physicians, attendings, fellows. And as this has been going on now for about 5 years, we've enlisted hospitalists, ER physicians, general surgery, nursing, respiratory therapists, and medical students. The course, pre-course PowerPoint that they view online, just go over it goes over key learning points and the anatomy of tracheotomy and laryngectomy, the role of the different types of trach tubes, cuffed versus uncuffed, intercannula versus no intercannula, fenestrated versus non-fenestrated, and the different lengths. Would you know, I don't know what type of trachs they use at your facility, but there's no standardization in the nomenclature for tracheostomies, and I'm sure a lot of you guys know that. So you receive a transfer in from another facility, and you don't have that trach, or you can't even tell the size of the trach because it's not even stamped on the side of it. We as a healthcare organization use Shiley's because that's just what we use because to avoid errors and to have some standardization within our system. So other things that the pre-course went over was decannulation, speaking valve use, tracheostomy complications, and then those algorithms that I showed you. And then the course was broken up into two separate groups. One group, Group A, went through, looked at the different types of trach tubes, and also used a surgical laryngoscope or a Dittoscope. And then the other group went with me and did the high fidelity simulation. And then we switched the groups. So there were two scenarios. The first one was a displaced trach. And the learner would come into a room, the simulation room, and the nurse would say, I've been having problems oxygenating this patient, and I have respiratory therapy, and we haven't been able to get the sats up. Well, the learner was to ask, well, how old is this trach? Is this a new trach or is this an old trach? And if they asked, they would find out that the trach was only 3 days old. So the management of a fresh trach is much different than the management of a chronic trach. And so they went through this. So the goal of this scenario was, if it's not patent, so if you don't have patency, pull it out and intubate from above immediately. Don't waste any time. And so that was the first one. If they had about 30 seconds, and the patient would go, if they didn't solve it within 30 seconds, the patient would crash and go into cardiac arrest. That way they could manage that as well with the airway. And I think that's more in tune with what we see, you know, in day-to-day scenario. The second scenario was a laryngectomy scenario. This was a John Doe. Nobody knew this patient. Patient comes into the ED, is having difficulty breathing, has a scarf around his neck. And if they don't expose the neck and see that they have a stoma, then the patient goes into cardiac arrest. And when the patient goes into cardiac arrest, they're trying to intubate from above, but the airway, they can't intubate from above because you can't intubate a laryngectomy patient from above. So they would, the idea was to pull the scab off and intubate through the stoma. So this last group that we did, when we conduct the course, it's part of their routine airway training at the very beginning of their fellowship, at the beginning of the first year. We followed up with a survey 8 months later. All respondents were strongly positive. And all of the respondents actually had encountered some sort of tracheostomy or laryngectomy issue in the past 8 months. And all thought that the scenarios were the most useful part. Here were just some notes from that. So now we're going to transition a little bit over to a different type of simulation. This is microsimulation. And I talked about this about 5 years ago, a project that we're involved with. This is something that you all can partake in. It's a freeware. It's an online mechanical ventilator simulator. It's called Save Me. And what is Save Me? It's a simulation model. It takes into account mechanics, gas exchange modules, acid base and hemodynamic modules. You're given a dynamic, responsive virtual patient population. And this is really the five major categories that we deal with respiratory failure. You've got a COPD, asthmatic, acute lung injury, recruitable, non-recruitable, restrictive lung disease, and pneumonia. The modules themselves, as you go through it, there's 100 of them, and there's 20 of them of those different subsets. You have real-time learner debriefing. So it's not you just go to a case and then go to the end and they say, oh, you got that wrong. it gives you debriefing as you're going along. And if you need help in solving the case, you can actually ask for help. Maybe. Okay, so this is the platform. This is initial presentation of a standardized patient. I'm not going to go all the way through one of these because you can log in and do it online. But this is the interface. Basically, what you have is you have airway flow diagram. You have the goals on your right are the goals for each patient that must be met to proceed to an additional case. And then you have the ventilator mode on your left-hand side. And it shows you what you can do with a patient, and it has the patient's vital signs in the center. So you can make a variety of changes just based on this information that you're given on this slide. Some people, novice users, will make one change. They'll increase the fraction of oxygen. Other people might make other changes. Some people might decide, oh, we just need to increase the rate that they're getting. Bad choice. O2 sats drop, blood pressure is low, and it tells you what's low. And as you go through these, you can make different interventions, and then ultimately you solve the case. And then it gives you another patient. So this freeware tool that has been developed, it's really taken off nicely. It's ranked, at the time this slide was made, it was ranked number one on Bing and number two on Google search. It's generating around 20 unique downloads a day spanning 98 countries. We've published on this looking at practice patterns what we're seeing is that you have a novice person that's learning how to use a mechanical ventilator, and then you have experts over here. And the goal is obviously take the novice over to becoming an expert. But what we're seeing is that the practice patterns that you have as a novice, they're very dispersed, and whereas an expert is very tight. And it follows along that of the same statistical characteristics that you would see in spoken language. And we've also published that evidence of cognitive conceptual clustering is readily apparent. And that's that basically saying that experts think like experts. Again, novice is very scattered. But this has been a very powerful tool that we're using to teach mechanical ventilation for our students and our fellows, and something that people are using around the world to actually train. Maybe they don't have a mechanically ventilated patient, or the incidence with which they manage one is low. This is an opportunity for them to exercise that. Another picture. So I have to stop for this picture. So the morning that we left for our trip, I have four kids, so this was a big deal to go on a trip. And that's my coffee mug on your left. And I'm looking down and I see these coffee grounds. I don't read coffee grounds, but I was looking at it and I was like, holy cow, it looks like the picture on the right. So I looked and looked and looked on a trip and I found a picture that resembled my coffee mug. Okay, so we've talked about high fidelity simulation, we've talked about micro simulation. Now we're gonna talk about something a little bit different, but in using simulation in a different way. And one of my colleagues, Dr. Blissard, has done this, and it's been wonderful. It's called You're Being Sued, When Bad Things Happen to Good Doctors. And the purpose of this workshop was to take the critical care fellows, let them have the opportunity to participate in a mock medical malpractice lawsuit that would provide basic understanding of the litigation process. And the goal at the end of the workshop was the fellows should have a general understanding of the procedural aspects of a malpractice case, how to recognize pitfalls inherent in poor documentation and communication, and the potential consequences of both at trial. That's the biggest one. And better defend their actions in litigation and document more intelligently. It was a longitudinal curriculum. It started during our core airway course in October. And then the deposition was in April, and the mock trial was in June. So a documentation video was recreated, of a failed reintubation of a previous critical care fellow. This failed reintubation by critical care program directors and some of the VA Pittsburgh simulation fellows. The key moments were timestamped with actual times documented in the patient chart. Fellows then viewed this video as part of their difficult airway training. They had no idea that this was going to be used later on. They had no idea. So we just asked them to document, what do you see, what's going wrong in this, or is anything going wrong in this reintubation? This is just a still shot from that. The mock deposition, one fellow was lucky and was selected to be deposed. They received a redacted copy of the initial complaint and a letter from the insurance company stating he was being sued. Actual lawyers deposed the fellow using the redacted chart, facilitated debriefing and Q&A session after the deposition with faculty, lawyers, and the VP of risk management. Then moved to mock trial. It was scripted from an actual patient chart, depositions, and expert witness summaries. Standardized patients were used to play the part of the defendant and expert witnesses. Fellows acted as jurors, deliberated the case, and rendered a verdict. Fellows were unable to come to a unanimous decision, but favored acquittal 9-4. This was an actual case settled by UPMC, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. So future goals with this was to create a documentation checklist. It's in process currently. We're using a Delphi model utilizing local critical care faculty to provide feedback on key aspects of fellow documentation. The second year fellows will play more of a role as we move forward, and we're looking at a possible affiliation with Pitt's Law School. We're also gonna focus more on mediation in the future as well, because most cases are settled before going to trial. The last thing that I want to talk to you about is integrating simulation or utilizing simulation into your hospital processes. We have a center at VA Pittsburgh called the Center for Medical Product End User Testing. It's led by Ms. Eastock. She was a human factors psychologist. In her previous life, she designed cockpits for aviation equipment. And then she's also a co-director for the Interprofessional Patient Safety Fellowship along with Dr. Ibling. So their mission is kind of like a Consumer Reports of medical equipment. The mission is to facilitate the safest use of medical products in the delivery of care to veterans. The approach is to conduct human factors evaluations to measure product safety in situations that mirror real clinical practice settings. And that's where I come involved with the high fidelity simulation. Involve representative set of users and incorporate real world scenarios. And measure the effects of interface design on user decisions and actions with the goal of maximizing performance and minimizing errors. Ultimately, the overarching goals are to advise the purchase of safe medical products across the VH. When you go to purchase a product, you're listening to a rep, and you're basically gauging that presentation by one rep against another rep or a competitor. And so the idea of this is to come together, test these things against each other in a non-biased environment to see which product is actually superior. And also to identify and mitigate safety issues before products are used on veterans, inform future design, development, and approval of safe medical products. So I'm just going to briefly go over two completed evaluations that we've done. One was a purchasing and one was a product design. So how many of you use automated chest compression devices? Any hands? I know you do. One, two. Okay, by choice. Okay, so we were the objective of this particular evaluation was we had a new ER director that had used these in his previous workplace, and he wanted to buy them for the VA. But if we were going to do one thing in the ER, we needed them to be available in the ICUs on our code response teams across the system, which was a large capital purchase. And so we asked the question, let's identify whether one of these devices would be safe and beneficial for use at VA Pittsburgh. So the methods, we had a simulation of a resuscitation scenario involving an unconscious 45-year-old male in cardiac arrest. The two devices that we were able to get with permission from the manufacturers was the AutoPulse and the Lucas 2. And what we looked at was the time of interruption of compressions. We all know that the AHA guidelines are is you don't want to have interruption in compressions of more than 10 seconds. And so the people that went through these scenarios were advised on how to do this. They were able to practice putting on, taking on and off these devices. And what we found was with the AutoPulse, the time of interruption was average time was 31.6 seconds. The Lucas 2 was 39.1 seconds. That far exceeds the recommendation of 10 seconds. So this actually, the impact of that study was that it prevented the purchase of this equipment and improve patient care. We thought that it would improve patient care because we're minimizing the interruption and cost savings. We then published our results in the journal, American Journal of Emergency Medicine. The last evaluation that I'm gonna talk about today is the medication label evaluation. And the objective of this was to quantify the impact of label design on medication safety in a realistic, high-stress clinical situation. So the scenario that we did was, this is a standard operation, it's an abdominal operation in a simulated OR setting, and a patient has an unexpected massive vascular injury. And there's an incorrectly stocked lidocaine bag within a stack of Hespan. So this evaluation occurred before we stopped. We do not use Hespan. But this is before that had occurred. And the labels for, at that time, the labels for Hespan and lidocaine were very similar. So you have a stack of Hespan, and what they did was they inserted one bag of lidocaine into that. And as they're trying to stabilize this patient, grab a bag of lidocaine. So we looked at the results of that. So we ran 20 of these scenarios, and 40% of the time, the correct medication selection was for the current label, and that improved to 63% with a redesigned label. So this was a label redesign. So the impact was is the hospital redesigned the labels placed on operating room medications for anything that's compounded in-house. So that was very interesting. What this group is doing then is they're looking at telemonitors, and they're expanding the things that they're doing, and they're looking for massive purchases across the VA nationwide, and then they're sharing this information. But it is the way I think of it is like a Consumer Reports